welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So get yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Speaking with Joy. I don't know if I'm catching you from last week and you're back to hear the first real episode, or if this is your first time listening, but either way, I'm very happy to have you. This is a podcast all about discussing and discovering great art and thinking about how it shapes ourselves and our world, and I am very happy to have you. I highly recommend you grab a cup of tea and sit down before we start all of our discussions. So if you tuned in last week, you'll know that I am doing a PhD up at St. Andrews University in Scotland, and this week has been a big week of work because I have a very special visitor coming in tomorrow, and I kind of have a fall break next week. Something that's weird about doing a PhD is that whereas in an undergraduate degree, you know, you have deadlines and you have these really intense exam periods, but you also have very set breaks. Whereas in the PhD life, you don't have tons of deadlines, but you also just kind of, you know, never have breaks. So it's all very much dependent on you. So even if you're not doing a lot, you're kind of just living in this never land of kind of no deadlines, no breaks. So this week I have made the decision that next week is going to be my fall break. I'm going to have Thanksgiving, I'm going to have my guest, and that'll be lovely. But the result of that means that I have been in a vortex trying to get this chapter done. So I have been locked either in my room at my desk, in my office with my colleagues, or in a coffee shop just reading and writing, which has made me a little mole. I have been absolutely underground and have just been doing nothing other than researching and writing. And it's really, I think this is just a tendency that academics has, that it can kind of make you just this kind of person where you're just buried in work and studying and thinking and writing. And it's really funny to see the effects of that, you know, with me and my colleagues. Like, they'll have these coffee hours that we're all supposed to go to socialize. And we all laugh when we get there because we're just so, you know, in our worlds from studying that we can hardly talk to each other. But I was talking to a friend the other day because one of the great things about St. Andrews is while I can be absolutely buried in my work and studying and locked up in a library, St. Andrews is also this incredibly beautiful place, you know, and so I can emerge and I can go walk on the North Sea, on one of the seashores, the East or West Sands, or I can go walk around the ruins of this gorgeous old cathedral, or I can go walk down the medieval paths that lead to this medieval graveyard called the Laid Braes. And it's just, it's vivid and it's lovely and it's beautiful. And so that's one kind of saving grace about St. Andrews, is that no matter how hard you work, you can walk out and be confronted with this incredible natural beauty. And I was talking with a friend about this the other day. We were walking on East Sands, and we were talking about, you know, the odd nature of academics, that everyone can kind of get hold into their subject and, you know, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and how you can kind of lose perspective. And he was like, you know, I just think everyone would have a better perspective on the world if they went and hiked a mountain or spent more time outside. And I thought that was absolutely true and is one of the reasons I'm thankful for St. Andrews. But something else that struck me about it was kind of the deeper fact that we look to nature to situate ourselves and to give ourselves a sense of context. You know, one of the things people most often say when they go into nature is, you know, they realize how small they are, and that kind of gives them a sense of their place in the world. I remember this summer, when I was back in Colorado, I went on a little hiking trip with one of my best friends, Rebecca, and we were going through these beautiful kind of mountain area near Buena Vista. I probably just pronounced that wrong. All the Coloradans tell me I do. And I just remember thinking that my problems and my worries seemed both less and more important. And really, that is to say, they just felt like they were put in perspective. So the podcast today is actually going to be along these lines of why do we look to nature when to find context? And specifically, why do people and artists in general tend to look towards nature when they're experiencing chaos or suffering? And what is it about nature that makes us feel comforted? But that comes with another little question, which is that while nature can feel comforting and can give us context, nature can also be a source of that chaos in our lives. You know, for the times that I have felt comforted by nature, there have also been times where it feels out of our control and where it feels like it is a source of chaos. So that is the theme for our podcast today. It is chaos and creation, looking at why we look to nature in our moments of chaos and asking the question of why do people look to creation in catastrophe, and why is it comforting and why is it not? So that is today's topic. I'm going to give you a preview, just so you can know it's coming, of the pieces we'll be dealing with. We'll start off with musical, and I actually have two musical pieces today of two very different genres. One will be Haydn's Creation Oratorio, and then we will look at the song Casimir Poliski Day by Sufjan Stevens. Then we'll move to a visual piece of art, which will be The Tree of Life by Terrence Malick. It's the director. And then finally, we will look to a literary piece of art, and we'll talk about God's Grandeur by Gerard Manley Hopkins. So, without further ado, let's dive into our first example. So our first example is Haydn's Creation Oratorio. Now, let me give you a little background on Haydn and then some kind of context for the piece and what it's trying to address, and so you can understand it a little better. And then I'll give you a tiny clip that you can listen to, and then I'll give you a link so that you can listen to the rest of it on your own. So Haydn was lived from 1732 to 1809. He is known as the father of the symphony and I believe of the string quartet, I think. Yeah. He was a mentor to Mozart and Beethoven. So the thing I always think of with Haydn is that while, you know, Beethoven, there's pieces we can really distinctly think of with him, or, you know, Handel, you think of the Messiah, Mozart, whatever. Haydn is, to me at least, he's not as recognizable by distinct pieces, but he's recognizable by kind of setting the tone for symphonies and for also being the person that mentored some incredibly, you know, Mozart and Beethoven, two of the most influential composers. He lived right at the height of the Enlightenment. So just a little historical reminder for you. That was the time kind of post-medieval when there was this sudden boom in scientific knowledge and experiment, and it was the age of reason. It was kind of the age where we moved from this trust in, this is, you know, painting with very broad brushstrokes, but a trust in tradition and imagination to this era of having this trust in reason and kind of in reason alone as how we get to things. And part of that was coming out of the scientific revolution, that they're like, wow, look at how we can, you know, accurately look at nature and understand it. And we can do that through reason. And isn't that great? So, you know, influential people around this time would be, you know, Newton was died just around the time that Haydn was born. With his huge and influential ideas on physics. And so this was kind of an era where people were emphasizing reason and were amazed at the orderliness of the world. So you can already kind of see where we're beginning to get to when we're talking about creation and chaos. So at this point, if you think about the way that nature was perceived, it was perceived as this great kind of almost mechanistic, gloriously mechanistic thing. So it was kind of like it was seen as this great clock that worked with intricacy and that was fine-tuned, and it was something we could study and dissect and find orderly laws in. And this was kind of looked on with amazement. Now, this is different than how maybe like a medieval way of seeing nature would have been. And because medieval saw it more not as something that was kind of like, you know, dead, not dead in the sense of dead, but like dead in the sense of a machine that could be plucked and looked through and kind of organized. They saw it as kind of this living organism that shaped our world and that stars meant things. And then you move into the Enlightenment era and they're kind of like, that's a little bit too much. The world is a clock that works well. And so then when you think about how they engaged with that with, you know, theology and religions is at this point, eventually it would kind of move towards people saying, oh, well, it's just a system and God's not a part of it. But at this point, there was kind of this sense of, oh, isn't the clock wonderful? Isn't the clock of nature orderly and perfect and ordered? And God made it. So Haydn writes his oratorio kind of just at the brink of that movement in the Enlightenment. It's before people are becoming kind of deistic, which is, you know, the idea that God kind of wound up the clock and left it alone and never had any more involvement with the world. It was kind of just before that. And it was at that cusp of the moment where you could both look at the order of creation and then also say, God did this. And that in bringing glory to the orderliness of creation, you could worship God through it. And so that is kind of like what this piece emerges into. It's this time of kind of glorying in the orderliness and the way that reason can determine everything. And Haydn does this beautiful mixture of both celebrating the orderliness and the, you know, machine clockworkness of the universe, but also of saying, and God did this, and isn't it glorious and lovely? So this was composed also, I don't remember if I said this, in 1797 to 98. Okay, I'm going to just show you a tiny little clip of this, and then we're going to talk more about it. Also, I have this linked in the blog post if you want to go find it and listen to the rest of it. And I asked my resident composer brother which would be the best version to use, and he said that he found me this great version that's directed by Leonard Bernstein, and so that is how I came to find this video. Okay, I'm going to show you, this is just a small clip from the very, very beginning. And remember, this is, I don't think I said this, it's also the actual text for the libretto is drawn from Genesis, so it's all focused around the Genesis account, and then the Psalms, and then Milton's Paradise Lost. So this is meant to be the very opening of creation, a kind of something from nothing moment. All right, I'll pause it there. So that's just the very, very opening, and you can see with that huge booming opening chord, it's kind of this moment of, in my mind, the music sounds like a great bit of light, you know, coming out of the darkness, and it's this huge sudden moment, which is just gorgeous and works so well when you're thinking about, you know, this creation moment, you know, in the beginning God created. So this kind of leads into when we're thinking about chaos and order, something that is really interesting, if you listen through this, that Haydn tries to depict, is he tries to depict chaos, basically. So what he tried to do with this is he was trying to create this image that in the music that we can experience where there's chaos and then God bringing order out of the chaos. And so, but his problem, of course, with this is that who wants to hear music that represents chaos? Like, that sounds very unpleasant. Of course, modern composers seem to have no scruples about representing such things, if they could even call it representing. but Haydn was in a different era, and so he was like, how do I represent this chaos? And this brings us to another question, which is something I don't think we usually think about in our era. But the idea that God brought order out of chaos is really important because that goes back to kind of some of the ancient myths and the difference between the Judeo, like the Hebrew Bible creation myth and the others at the time that were emerging around that time in other religions. Because in many of the, you know, the Greek myths and the ancient Eastern myths, creation, what we think of creation, was an act of chaos. So it would happen when the gods went to war and then all of their dead carcasses. That's what the earth is. That's how creation happened. We are living on the dead carcasses of the gods. And of course, that creates this very like negative view of materiality. It creates this very negative view of the world that we live in. And they start to think that, you know, really it's bodies being trapped in the material world that's bad. So that's the image that you had in these old ancient myths was, you know, the world is created out of warfare or even out of rape, out of these very negative things. But the Genesis account has this different version, which is it kind of sees, you know, you have in Genesis, it talks about the spirit hovering over the void. And we'll get back to that word hovering because it means more like brooding, like a bird. Hovering over the void. So it's a sense that there is chaos. And then the creation narrative is this bringing chaos into cosmos, bringing it into order and beauty. And so Haydn tries to represent that in his music. He has this whole kind of tentative, dissonant first section that's then brought into this beautiful, orderly moment. And then, it, you know, you have this moment where everyone sings, "Let there be light." And it's this huge, it's just beautiful. You'll have to listen to it. So that's something he really centers around is that it creates this vision of the world where the natural world is something that God created cosmos and order out of chaos. So when you think about that, it makes a lot of sense why someone like Haydn would look to creation in moments of chaos as a source of comfort. Because it's this picture of while I may have internal, you know, dissonance or I may have sin or whatever, or I may experience negativity in the world, well, when I look to the natural world, I see something that is orderly, that God has created order and loveliness and cosmos out of. But that brings us to a little bit of a problem with Haydn's view. So I said earlier, of course, that he did the libretto is based off of Genesis and Milton and the Psalms. Now, he's basing the libretto partially off of Milton's Paradise Lost. And what's important about that is Milton's work is describing Paradise Lost. So it's describing creation, but its whole point is to show what has become fallen. And Milton really vividly describes this. You know, he describes it in these terms that make you realize that the fall permeates just beyond moral evil. It's also this kind of chaotic evil in nature. But what's strange is that Haydn doesn't even include a hint of that. You know, he doesn't even include any hint of there being a disorderedness in nature itself, a chaos in nature as we know it. And of course, that creates a lack. It creates a kind of an off balance in the way he's seeing nature, because something that is native to our experience is that as much as nature is beautiful and orderly, it can also be an agent of chaos. It can be indifferent. It can cause pain. So that's something I find really interesting about Haydn is that to me, his piece beautifully illustrates why we look to nature because we sense this order and this beauty in it that's, you know, that goes on, that's that can be comforting, right? It's this kind of sense of the order that goes underneath my disordered life. But the problem is that he totally occludes any sense that we might experience difficulty or pain at the hands of nature. Which brings us to our second piece, which is Casimir Paluski Day by Suvian Stevens. Now, Suvian Stevens is an odd character. He is, quite frankly, one of my favorite indie artists. He does all kinds of music. He is both unafraid to use strange instrumentation and horns in his music, and he's also unafraid to address the most difficult and tender issues. And I think for both of those reasons, I really like him. And this song we're going to listen to comes off of one of his projects called "Come On, Feel the Illinois," and he did this one. He had this plan to write an album for every state in the United States. He only made it through Michigan and Illinois, but they're both great albums. They're very odd, and they kind of, he tried to get the feeling of each state and kind of put in some of its myths and its, you know, the things that are iconic to the places that he's writing about. And this song specifically is, it's a really beautiful way of dealing with kind of this tension that nature presents to us. Because I think that what we all experience in our lives and also when we look to nature is that creation presents us with a dichotomy. Because we see beauty and order and glory in creation, which we find comforting and inspiring, even as we experience sometimes chaos at the hands of nature. So what do we make of this? Do we say that nature is something that brings us comfort and gives us this place of centering in the world? Or is it an agent of chaos? And that's kind of what this song by Sufjan Stevens represents. So I'm just going to play you a tiny clip and then we'll discuss it together. Okay.
2, 3, 4. Things I brought you when I found out you had cancer off the bone. Your father cried on the telephone, and he drove his car into the Navy Yard just to prove that he was sorry. In the morning, through the window shade, when the light pressed up against your shoulder blade, I can see what you were reading. All the glory that the Lord has made, and the complications you could do without, when I kissed you on the mouth.
Alright, so I'm going to pause it there. And I will include links where you can go to listen or buy the song. So as you probably got the feeling of from the first little bit, it's a story song, and it's written from his perspective. I'm not sure if this is actually something that happened in his life or if this is living in somebody else's story. But it's about this person who is watching as someone he loves, this girl that he loves in a kind of romantic and innocent way, has cancer, and the song ultimately ends in her dying. And the whole song is kind of his exploration of grief, but also of the glory that he sees in creation. And what's interesting about it is that at the one hand, you see him experiencing, this grief of his beloved person who has cancer. And that cancer, you could say, is something that is chaos at the hands of nature. It's something that, it's something happening from nature. It's not just social or emotional evil. It's something that is literally in the physical world causing death. But then at the same time, all through the song, four different times, he has this line. You heard it in that one, where he goes, "All the glory that the Lord has made." And then he says, "And the complications you could do without." And then he describes one of the complications. But you kind of have this place he goes back to over and over again as he's experiencing this great grief, and yet he's also experiencing these moments of beauty. And the whole song is kind of this wrestling with, what do I do with these two things that seem true? One, that I'm experiencing this great sadness at the hands of nature and of the world, and on the other hand, that I keep on experiencing all this glory that the Lord has made. And that in some ways, the glory complicates the suffering, because he feels like these are both true, and that the glory kind of speaks to something beyond just itself, So in this great experience of loss, Sufjan can't get away from these experiences of beauty, and he feels like they gesture to something, deeper or truer, or that goes beyond this experience of loss. And what I love about this, and I think why I learned to love the song when I first heard it. I think I first heard it when I was about 15. And what I always loved about it was that it doesn't try to simplify that, And that's so true of life, to both have this experience of difficulty and suffering and to say, this is really hard, but then also to kind of experience this inexplicable sense of the giftedness of the world and the glory that can come through, you know, in the song he talks about the light pressing up against her shoulder blade as she's reading a book, and a spring morning, and a December morning. And he's looking at these two things, you know, the brokenness of the world and saying, yeah, that's true. And then also looking at the beauty of it and saying, these things are both true and I don't know how to make sense of them. I don't know how to hold them together. He's trying to kind of reconcile these two truths of nature, both that nature brings chaos and pain, but also that there are these moments of unutterable glory that seems a kind of gesture to this sense of meaning or something beyond just the pain that we're experiencing from nature. So to me, when I think about Haydn and Sufjan, of course, they're incredibly different pieces, so you can't really compare apples to oranges. But to me, Haydn is focusing on, you know, the order of creation, that it's orderly, that we can trust it, that it works like a clock, and there is some comfort in that. But I think that Sufjan's experience of nature seems more like my experience, you know, that we experience chaos at the hands of nature, even while having this sense of beauty that goes beyond the chaos we experience, and kind of not knowing what to do or how to reconcile these two things. You know, what do we do with the glory that the Lord has made, and the complications that come with it? I just think that refrain is so beautiful and kind of captures the heart of Sufjan's kind of faith in this song. What do you do with the glory and the complications? You can't call one of them false. Both of these are true, the difficulty and the beauty. So Sufjan, when he looks to nature, he finds it both comforting and complicated. You know, when we were talking earlier about why is it that in these moments of disorder and chaos in our own lives, we look to nature? For Sufjan, he doesn't find comfort in the sense that it's like it solves his issues. He doesn't just go, oh yes, I have very difficult things, but isn't nature nice? He says, when I look to nature, it complicates my view of things because I realize there's something in nature that makes me not want to despair, which is such an interesting thing. And he brings this up again in other music. He wrote an album recently called Carrie and Lowell, and it's talking about the death of his mother. And one of the songs called, I think it's The Only Thing, he paints this picture of, you know, why do I go on living? Why do I go on hoping and living a life of faith? And his answer is kind of, because there's this beauty and this glory that I find in creation that I can't despair in, I can't say no to. So I've loved that, and I love that kind of picture in his writing. And that's been something that that's struck me many times, as you know, when I've had moments of sadness and times that were difficult in my life. I remember having this thought once when I was going on a walk, and I was going through particularly kind of a time of winter, you know, and of sadness. And I was walking in my little, on the golf course near my house in Colorado, and there was this gorgeous sunset. And I remember thinking, you know, my sadness will be finite. You know, at some point, this sounds very silly, but at some point either I will not be sad or I will die. And, but there's something in the glory and the beauty of this nature that will go on. And that doesn't solve it, but it means that there's this part of me that goes, well, if that can go on, then I should learn to hope again. So that, I think, is really the heart of this song, is getting to how do you hold both the glory and the chaos? And so I could talk all day, but I think this is a really worthwhile song to think about. So for the next one, we're going to move on to Terrence Malick and the Tree of Life. So this is a movie unlike any other. Whenever people watch it, I always tell them to kind of give yourself over to it. Don't try to figure out what it's about, because in the words of Malin Lingle, I think when you get to the end of it, you may not know what it means, but you will know what it is about. And it's this real experience. You kind of just have to, you know, dive into it and let yourself be washed over by it. It's absolutely beautifully shot. And one of the main things it does is focus on these gorgeous shots of nature in various ways, which we can talk about. The story essentially is, and I'm not giving away anything that you wouldn't find out in the first 5 minutes of the film, but it's sort of a modern retelling of Job in some ways, and it's looking at this experience of grief through the eyes of a mother. It's the characters are kind of mother and brother, but it's the mother and the son of this difficult thing that happens, which I will let you see if you watch the movie. And it's them posing their questions. You'll have these like kind of in-between sequences where you'll hear the mother or the brother articulating these questions and these issues and these kind of sadnesses to God. And then the whole movie is kind of a working through those in the very ordinary life of this family in Waco, Texas in the 1950s. And I heard one of my professors here calls it kind of it's a narrative or a visual theodicy. So the whole question is, you know, working through this grief and, you know, saying, how can God be good in this sadness? And its answer is not a reason or, you know, an argument. It's these depictions of nature, which is a really interesting way to get at that. And of course, and getting at the question, that question in that way, we have this natural tension of if your answer to the problem, to these problems and this grief that this family is experiencing, kind of to the problem of evil, is in nature, you bump up against the problem of, well, is nature really a good answer? Because she is both, sorry, talking about nature as a she, but nature is both beautiful and glorious, but also has her own fair share of chaos. So how is that an answer? So throughout the movie, you've got these really, there's this really fascinating scene where the mother kind of, I think she asks the questions that you would read from Job. I think it's lifted straight out of Job. And then in response to her seeming questions, you go through this amazing creation sequence. And it's kind of like, you know, starts with this huge explosion, and then you see all the stars, and then you see kind of the developing of the earth over time, and then you see dinosaurs. And it's this wild thing because you're watching the movie and you think, you know, oh, I'm watching a nice movie about the 1950s. And then all of a sudden you're watching like this 20-minute scene of, you know, the creation of the universe. But it's interesting because that's kind of her answer to her prayer. But what's fascinating about it is it's not just a, well, you have problems. Look how big the world is. Get over it. Because, and the way, part of the way we know that is that as it's going through this, this beautiful music is playing over it. But the music is lacrimosa, which means tears. So you kind of have this interesting mix of that even as she's being answered for her prayer through creation, this tears are playing over it. And you have all these kind of senses in the creation sequence that there's already bits of brokenness and issues within it. So that's, it's like an answer, but it's not an answer to her. But I think the real answer that you get in the Tree of Life are all these images of water. So throughout the movie, in kind of innocuous ways, but in very obvious and recurrent ways, you see all these beautiful depictions of water. And in the movie, it tends to kind of point to these representations of birth and rebirth. And so it'll be everything from, you know, her washing dishes to the little boys swimming in a lake to someone using a hose. And it's these many different kind of, it's this recurrent thing that comes back over and over again. And every time you see it, the way that they depict it, it makes these really ordinary moments just seem like shocking graces. You know, you see her playing with the hose and spraying the boys and laughing. And the way it's filmed, you just have this moment of utter awe that you even exist. And I do think that that's part of the answer that the movie is getting at, is we have these questions, but part of the first question is the grace of even existing. You know, why is there something rather than nothing? And that's kind of what the movie helps you to get to, is it helps you to get to this view of the world as charged with beauty and with loveliness. And we realize we can't explain the difficulties or the suffering, but we also can't explain the glory. And then the glory also kind of has these images of birth and this sense of, does nature herself want to be reborn? And you'll have to kind of watch the movie, but there's hints of that too. So The Tree of Life deals with this question of creation and chaos by, in the same way as Sufjan Stevens' song, kind of acknowledging that even in the beauty and the glory, there's also this tinge of lacrimosa, of tears. And then we see with all these images of water, this kind of desire, even of creation itself, to be reborn. And to be washed, to be clean. So it's absolutely beautiful. And then also going along with that, that sense of just, it's almost like it's like taking you and focusing you on these tiny, beautiful details of nature to realize the miracle of even existing. And it makes you kind of thankful for every cell in your body. I had kind of experienced that this summer because in a really weird mood, I was like, I'm going to read a physics book because, you know, I'll never be able to do that while I'm doing my PhD, so I might as well do it now, which is ridiculous, and I don't know why I did that, but I'm glad I did. And I read Brian Greene's book, The Fabric of the Cosmos, and I'm sure that if there's any physicists out there, you'll be like, oh, Joy, that's very outdated. But I learned so much from it. I think I only understood like 45%, maybe. But generally what it impressed upon me is that the more physicists press into the world, the more we discover this kind of, you know, there's the technical term for it. He calls it this fine-tuned universe. That everything is just so. That our planet is just so. That the intricacy of how we exist is kind of beyond imagination. And I think it's interesting, too, that he used the word cosmos with that sense that relates earlier to what we're talking about of the ordered rather than the chaos, the cosmos. So that's kind of something to me that when I watch Tree of Life, it brings to me is this, it kind of shakes up your snow globe and makes you realize the miracle of existing, even if we can't quite parse out the lacrimosa from the cosmos, the sadness and the tears from the cosmos. So that's definitely worth watching. It's sort of long. Somehow I've seen it 3 times in the last year, which is honestly maybe too much. Like, it's a beautiful movie, but maybe don't watch it 3 times in a year. That's my advice to you. I think in some ways the movie shows that we look to creation because it reflects our intuitive sense, both of the sadness of the world, but also of the glory and kind of the, you can't even begin to know what it is to exist. Okay, so I suppose that I have both answered and not answered at this point my question. Why do we look to creation to experience comfort? But I think that we can begin to see that we do look to creation to experience comfort because there is an order and a wonder in existing that kind of reminds us of the miracle that it is to exist and that is somehow comforting. But that even in that, we kind of hold this tension of both seeing glory and beauty, but then also seeing that nature can sometimes be the agent of chaos. And so what do we make of that? And I think Sufjan Stevens is the best picture of that, of kind of holding those two truths together. So for our last piece of art, we're going to be looking at a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins. GMH is one of my favorite poets. I'm going to read to you out of a lovely little, it's very old, purple book of his poems that one of my good friends here in Scotland got for me because I knew I loved him. And it's one of my happiest books. I sometimes carry it with me just because I like reading his poems every once in a while. Hopkins was a Jesuit priest in England in the 19th century. He was writing just around the time of the Industrial Revolution. And I think that's really important to know about him because that was a time at which everybody thought about nature in the sense of like dominating it, of being able to control it and use it and override it. And so there was this kind of this sense of like nature being the enemy that we needed to subdue, or, you know, kind of the land that we needed to colonize, for lack of a better phrase. And Hopkins really felt like that was damaging. And he was right in many senses. You know, we see how the effects of the Industrial Revolution, even just at the very beginning, began to pollute towns. And I think his intuition was that we can't see nature as something to dominate, and that when we do that, it actually has worse effects for us. It's funny, if you read Gerard Manley Hopkins' Wikipedia page, it says that he's famous for his topics of nature and religion. And I kind of laughed when I read that because I thought nobody who actually read Gerard Manley Hopkins could put those in two different categories for him. Because to Hopkins, nature is one of the places that we experience God. There is something in creation and beauty that we kind of get a sense of God for us. And so I shouldn't say much more. I'm going to read you the poem. And just so you know, many people make fun of me for reading this because it's one of my moments where I get all Anne of Green Gables and love it. So laugh if you want to, but let me begin reading. This is God's Grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and, ah, bright wings. Ugh, isn't it beautiful? Okay, so I did read that, but I have also memorized this, so that is emblematic of how much I love this poem. I just think it's so beautiful. I love the feeling of the words when you're reading them, which is something that Hopkins is also famous for. He kind of coined the term sprung rhythm, which is to make poems that, even though they're in form, they kind of imitate normal speech. Okay, so this poem, you should memorize it for moments when you're looking at great sunsets, that you can just, you know, quote it to people, which is super cool. It's actually a little nerdy, but I think you should do it anyway, because I like doing it. No, but in all seriousness, I just love this. Okay, so something that we can talk about first with this is, like I was saying, that sense of God being present in creation. And I love that opening line where he says, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. So with this, I think of like an electric shock. You know, if you walk around with socks on and then you touch a doorknob, like a metal doorknob, and it shocks you. That's kind of what I think about when he says the world is charged with the grandeur of God. He's saying that, you know, if you would just see the world, it would shock you with God's presence in it. It's charged like a wire. And for him, he says that one of the great problems of men's suffering is that we have, it's like he says in that line, it's bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. Basically says that by cutting ourselves off from nature, we've cut ourselves off from an experience of newness and of God. You know, our foot cannot feel being shod. And you see there all that imagery he uses, very Industrial Revolution, of the oil and the toil and the trade. But I think the last line is what is, well, before I get to the last line, I think the line where he says, and for all this, nature is never spent. And I think that line, to me, is why I look to nature most as a source of comfort when you're experiencing chaos in your life. There's this sense of nature's kind of on and onness. Not just, so that's the order. So there's a sense of order in nature, the on and onness, it never being spent, but then also of beauty, that it's never spent and it's something that is good, that goes on and on, that for all of the smear and the trade and the toil, nature is never spent. And I think that does give us our context. You know, when you get holed up in that library or you get holed up with that difficulty, there's this sense that when you look at the never spentness of nature and breathe in, you kind of feel your place in it. And that is incredibly comforting. But I think it's also important that he places that in the context of that very last line, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and bright wings. And he is actually lifting that straight out of Genesis 1. This image of the Holy Ghost as a kind of as a mother bird of some kind. Here is your biblical interpretation fun fact for the week. It's one of my favorite fun facts about a misinterpretation of the Bible. In Genesis 1, when it says, and the Spirit of God moved over the waters, that word moved should be translated as hover or brood. It's imaging in Hebrew. It's a very image-driven language. It's imaging a bird hovering over nests, bringing new life. So in this very opening sequence of Genesis, God is being imaged as this mother hen brooding over her eggs. And so Hopkins just basically lifts that straight out and puts it at the end. And he says, this is why nature is never spent, because there's this sense of God's continual life-giving presence in the natural world. And to me, I think that also gets to the heart of why we look to creation. Because I think there's a sense of, even though we can experience chaos in the hands of creation, and we see, you know, death, and it's its own case of chaos, we also see in nature these kind of patterns of hope. You know, you have returning spring every year. You have this great kind of breadth and complexity and beauty. And all of those things kind of point beyond themselves. Augustine would say that was a sign. It was something that was going beyond sign or signifier. And Hopkins' reason for this is, he says, the reason we see this never spentness of nature and we find comfort in it is because we find the hope of the Holy Ghost, you know, of there being this life-giving spirit that will bring life again in nature and again in us. And I think to conclude, I recently read this lovely little kind of lesser-known essay by C.S. Lewis called Life in the Atomic Age. And he talks all about, basically, like, it's a great essay, and I won't discuss most of it. He talks about, you know, basically, how do you live in a world where the world might be annihilated any moment. And what he really gets down to at the end of it, listen to the rest of it, is he's basically saying that even at the heart of it, nature is beautiful, and it seems to signify something beyond itself, but even nature is tending towards its own funeral at some point. And it was funny because as I was, you know, just in the sense of, we live in a world of entropy where things tend towards decay. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about this podcast when I was walking into town the other day. And as I was thinking about that, I literally walked by a funeral, one of these big, beautiful churches. And it was kind of somber to me to see that. But then what Lewis talks about also is, he says, nature in some ways is our sister. And in the same way that we look to nature and see these grand signs of hope and of beauty and of glory, you see that nature also wants a redemption. It wants an orderedness that it doesn't see yet. It wants the life-giving presence of the Holy Ghost to move it towards something final and beautiful. And so he ends it with saying, it too, you know, wants redemption. And part of the reason that we love nature is because, in the same way that humankind is really possessed of this great ability of to be good and to be lovable and honorable and beautiful, but we also have these experiences of flaws and of desire for to be made whole. Part of the reason we love nature is because she reflects that experience. She reflects the creative and ordered and beautiful nature that God has given us, but also the need for redemption. And I think of, you know, Romans when it says, all of creation groans for the redemption of all things. And I think that at the heart of it is what we learn and why we look to creation, because it reflects our experience of the world, of the great beauty and the great chaos we experience, and our longing for that to be redeemed. And that even in that longing, we experience nature never being spent, and the Holy Ghost brooding, and this new life that we can sense as kind of present in creation. Okay, well, that's me for the week. It was so fun to be able to talk to you guys about that. I hope you'll remember Haydn for his love and appreciation, his enlightenment, surety of the orderliness of creation, and that you'll remember Casimir Pulaski and his holding together of the glory and all the complications that it makes, even as we experience sad things. And then Terrence Malick and the Tree of Life, and thinking about, you know, how nature reminds us of the wondrousness of being alive, and that in some ways is the answer to our quandaries. And finally, Gerard Manley Hopkins and the never spentness of nature, and the way that nature can be something that communicates the hope of redemption to us. I am very excited for this next week. I'll be off on my fall vacation that I have made for myself. I hope that you all have beautiful weeks and that you will join me next week when we'll talk about whatever I decide to talk about. All right, you all, this has been Speaking with Joy. Have a lovely week.